This is Alex, and on the phone with me is Professor Noam Chomsky, renowned linguist, Institute Professor Emeritus of Linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he taught for over half a century, the author of dozens of books. His most recent, A New Generation Draws the Line, Humanitarian Intervention and the Responsibility to Protect Today, the expanded edition. Professor Chomsky is one of America's most enduring anti-war activists and has spent most of his life translating documents from the lingo politic to us so that we might also be privy to the bare facts of the workings of our political system in America. Welcome, and thank you for being with us today.
Very pleased to be with you.
Professor Chomsky, you've summarized your politics as challenging all forms of authority and attempting to eliminate them if they are unjustified. That sounds to me like the definition of freedom, which our history was built on, and that's the reason why we're the freest nation in the world. Does it matter to you which political party you offend or promote by your views?
No, not particularly. In fact, I find plenty to criticize in both of them.
So politics is not a main issue for you?
Politics does not mean loyalty to a party. Unless you're in the Communist Party or something, or some, you know, some sect. It means making choices and evaluating. There have been times when I've voted for Republicans. There have been times where I voted for Democrats. Depends who they are, what the circumstances are. At times when I voted against all of them, you know, maybe Green or something like that.
So the main point is, are we being served? And is it something that we can live with? And if not, what can we do about it?
Well, I think we're in a very dangerous situation today in a lot of respects. One of them, in fact, has to do with democracy. So there is, democracy has many dimensions. It's not yes or no. But one fairly reasonable measure of democracy is how close public policy is to the public will. Now, you don't expect to be perfect. I mean, our elected representatives are not supposed to look at polls and just do what the polls say. But in a functioning democracy, public opinion and public policy ought to be fairly closely aligned. If not, there's something wrong with the system. If you take a look at the United States today, the gap between public opinion and public policy is a chasm. So take, for example, what's been the most important central issue in Washington in the past months, the deficit. What does the public think the major issue is? Well, we know very well, there are extensive polls. Overwhelmingly, the public thinks the major issue is jobs, and the deficit's a minor issue. And they incidentally happen to be correct in my judgment. The deficit may turn out to be a problem in the long term, but right now it's not a major problem. You can tell that by just looking at interest on bonds. People or investors are very happy to buy U.S. Treasury bonds at very low rates because they don't think there's a problem. Jobs, on the other hand, is a huge problem. For the banks, the deficit's a problem. They don't like deficits. It might ultimately, not in the near future, but ultimately lead to inflation, which is not a serious prospect today, but they don't like it. So on the one hand, you have the banks. On the other hand, you have the population. Take a look at policy. It's the deficit. It's a deficit commission, no jobs commission. Well, just keep to the deficit, a minor problem from the point of view of the public. How do you deal with the deficit? Well, the public has opinions about that, pretty strong opinions and pretty consistent ones. By a very large margin, the public believes that we should preserve the benefits that we have, like Medicare and Social Security, and that we should reverse the policy of sharply reducing taxes for the very wealthy. We should go back to what taxes were during the period of substantial economic growth in the 50s and 60s, the 90s again. So we should increase taxes on the tiny percentage of the population, actually a fraction of 1%, that has gained enormously from the policies of the past generation, while for the majority there's been virtual stagnation. Well, those are the public attitudes. The policy is going to be the opposite. No taxation on the very wealthy cutting away at benefits. Those are exactly the policies that are being proposed. Now, there's a kind of a invented terminology in this case. They've invented a new term for the super rich. You're not supposed to call them the super rich. You're supposed to call them the job creators. These people, we have good evidence. These are people who are sitting on the greatest profits in the history of corporate America. It's breaking records at the same time that the pay for working people is declining to its lowest level. So what we're supposed to do, according to the Republican Party, it's almost unanimous, is to stuff the pockets of those whose pockets are already bulging with dollars that they don't know what to do with, and harm those who are suffering. Well, you know, this is so far, and the Democrats are not saying, yes, let's do that, but they're not that far behind. So, for example, some of the leaks from the Deficit Commission committee meetings indicated that the Democrats were proposing partial privatization of Medicare. Well, that's if you partially privatize Medicare, that will in fact reduce the federal deficit, but by transferring the costs to the elderly, it takes the costs away from the tax system, which has at least some participation by the very rich, and you hand it over to the elderly who don't have the money for it. It's just class war of the kind that's been going on for 30 years.
And the class war that's being presented to us isn't necessarily coming from the people, correct? I see both right and left believe that the job creators are the people that are the small businessmen, not the super rich that are taking our jobs out of our country because globalization has made it cheaper and more profitable to do business elsewhere.
That's one of the factors, and we should also remember that the federal government is a major job creator. In fact, it's also a major source of innovation, dynamism, creation of new technology, and so on. I mean, everybody uses the computer and the Internet these days, but not many people are aware of the fact that mostly that came out of federal government spending in the 50s and primarily in the 1950s and the 1960s. Decades later, it was handed over to private entrepreneurs to turn into commodities. And that's the same right across the board, pharmaceuticals, the IT revolution, and much else. But small businesses and the federal government are the major job creators. Multinational corporations, you know, the really big ones, are creating jobs, but overseas, as you say.
Yeah.
For them, it's more profitable to exploit super cheap labor in Foxconn in China than to pay decent wages here. And that also should be reversed. If we don't have a manufacturing system in the United States, the country's really going to decline.
Yeah. Our GDP decline is frightening. But what got us here?
There are two major developments that have taken place in roughly the past 30 years, and they're related. One of them is what you mentioned, the offshoring of production and manufacturing for reasons of profit, not private profit harms the country. The second, which is associated with it, is the shift of the economy from production of things that are needed to financial manipulations. The financial institutions, which used to operate the way banks are supposed to work in a capitalist society, in the 50s and the 60s, the major growth period in American history, in fact, world history. During that period, a bank was a bank. It took unused capital, like, say, your bank account, and transferred it to some constructive use, like starting a business or sending your kid to college or, you know, buying a house or something. Since the late 70s and increasingly over the years, these financial institutions have been essentially playing games with money, speculating against currencies, trying to cut off a second from trading times, things like that. That does almost nothing for the economy, probably harms it. And it takes a huge amount of the available capital. By 2007, just before the latest crash, financial institutions were actually making about 40% of corporate profit, which is grotesque. So, and that's part of the means by which a tiny fraction of the population has enriched itself beyond the dreams of avarice, while for the general population there has been something like stagnation. That has other effects. It's poisoned the political system. The cost of elections has gone way up, and that means that they're, to a larger and larger extent, bought by concentrated wealth, corporate wealth, that's the source of concentration of capital. And at the congressional level, I mean, it used to be that if somebody would move ahead to a position of some prestige and influence in Congress, it was a result of seniority or service or something like that. Now, increasingly, chairmanships are bought. The money has to go into the party coffers. That, again, drives political leaders into the pockets of the very wealthy. And all of this forms a kind of a vicious cycle, which is getting worse and worse. The recent distribution of income is the worst it's ever been. And the decline of the functioning of the democratic system is similar. It's in parallel. These are real problems.
Yeah. I think that Democrats and Republicans can agree that legislators are being bought by lobbyists, and that the amount of money just to be elected is so huge that one has to become corrupt in order to just enter the system.
That's always been true to some extent, but it's become greatly exaggerated in the past generation. Another thing that's happened in the past generation is financial crises. Starting with the Reagan years, there have been repeated financial crises. Before that, there were, in the Eisenhower and the Kennedy Johnson years, 50s and 60s, there were no financial crises. The New Deal regulations were in place, and the banks were functioning, as I said, more or less like banks, not like speculators. The first big financial crisis was in the early 80s, another one later in the Reagan years. Reagan left office, leaving the worst financial crisis since the Depression, the savings and loan crisis. There was another one at the end of the Clinton years, the tech bubble burst, and the monster of all crises that we're right in the middle of, that's the Bush crisis, second Bush, bursting of the housing bubble, $8 trillion of paper wealth lost. Countries take a long time to emerge from that. And these are direct results of legislative decisions like deregulation, which have the almost inevitable consequence of leading to these results. Well, that is to the benefit of a top tiny fraction of the population, but not of the rest of us.
So where there's market unrest caused by, say, the possibility of a shipping problem or weather or any one of a multitude of reasons, prices go up. Who benefits from that?
Well, speculators benefit. And, of course, resource producers, mm-hmm. They do benefit when oil prices go up. But a lot of it, in food as well, is driven by speculative markets. And now we're back to the same financial institutions and speculators. None of this has to happen. These are not economic necessities. These are political choices. Same is true of bailouts. I mean, again, since the Reagan years, there has been, when deregulation really went into force and these other developments escalated, there has been a government insurance policy for big banks, what's called too big to fail. They know that they can make risky transactions, make a lot of money from them, and since they're risky, they're sooner or later going to crash, and when they do, the taxpayer will come in and bail them out. That's been going on since the early 80s.
And that's a dangerous policy.
It was very dangerous. There's a word for it in the economics literature. It's called moral hazard. But it's built into the way we're our current political economic system is functioning.
It's like our economic system has changed from one that's based on real life things into just virtual economics.
It's changed from, as you move manufacturing, meaning production of useful goods, as you move that abroad and you shift the economic behavior into speculation, quick multiple financial transactions, a couple of seconds of trading up and back. As you do that, it means that for the general economy and society, things are getting worse, even though a small sector, typically hedge fund managers, CEOs, others, a very tiny sector, it's actually a tenth of a percent of the population, have just become spectacularly wealthy.
With the ease of transfer of wealth. Meanwhile, the general public who need jobs are out.
Yeah, there's been for roughly 30 years, a little more, a fairly general stagnation. People have been getting by in the United States, but by measures that aren't sustainable. One of them is debt. Well, obviously, that's not sustainable. Another is asset inflation, like, you know, bubbles, which, of course, burst. Another is just by working more. Americans now work longer hours than, I think, probably any industrial society, far more than Europe. And that's a cost, too. It means you don't have leisure. And that means that you have to have the two members of the family working. And without real support systems like government daycare, it's very hard to have child care and so on. Another problem in the United States, and it's a very serious one, is the health care system. Our health care is actually an international scandal. It's more than twice the per capita cost of other industrial countries, Europe, Japan, and so on. And it doesn't have good outcomes, has some of the worst outcomes. And the reason is it's largely privatized and unregulated. The other systems are either government systems or closely regulated. And, you know, in fact, if anyone really cares about the deficit, we could wipe out the deficit completely by just having the same kind of healthcare system that other industrial countries do. Now, that's not a utopian dream.
And if people wanted to look into the success of those healthcare systems and find out for themselves whether they work or not, where can they go for that kind of news?
Well, there is very good information available. On these topics, there is a very good economics website, which has constant information on all these things. It's cepr.net. It's CEPR stands for Council on Economic and Political Research. There's several that have similar titles, so you got to get the right one. This one is cepr.net. They have a constant, highly reliable, very informative discussion just of the basic facts, like, say, healthcare and other a deficit, other economic issues.
And there people can get the true news without any spin.
Yeah, you get the data and sensible analysis. The main economist there, Dean Baker, is kind of a free market economist. He's highly critical of a lot of what passes for economic reporting, but he's highly respected and very good. He gets the facts right and the analysis right.
So that kind of information is available to the public, and we just need to find that information. I think we do get better with each person that rises to a higher evolution during their life. Some do it through art, others through technical skill, and some give clarity to the masses and help civilization as a whole to evolve. That, Professor Chomsky, is a hugely worthy life, and I'd like to thank you for your consistent efforts in raising the awareness of the general public. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for inviting me. I very much appreciate it.
I'm Alex Heil, and we've been speaking with Professor Noam Chomsky from his home in Massachusetts. I ask you to consider that we are not two completely different sides warring against each other, but more likely a huge middle with extreme edges. It does not matter whether you look at it through a left or a right eyeglass. We are all getting manipulated. I think we all agree on that. It is a safe bet to divide us by convincing us that the other guy is the enemy. When we all agree that we are tired of corruption, we all agree that we don't want waste. The system is corrupt. It is broken. It is not being led by us. It is being led by lobbyists and special interest money. Remember this. We the people. United we stand. Divided we fall. Well, who are we the people? Look in the mirror. If not you, then who? So if the system is broken, we the people are the only ones who can fix it. It is time to get off the proverbial couch and get your mind into it. Think for yourself.